Big changes could come to the nursing home industry in Florida. Is it about time? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The upcoming legislative session will include numerous bills that tackle nursing home issues. They are the result of a tragedy during Hurricane Irma. The deaths of 12 patients from the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills are now listed as homicides. We'll learn more about those bills and what it could mean for the industry. Miami Art Week is almost here. We're going to look at museums. There are plenty in Miami, as well as some public art collections that are privately owned. The other Miami art world not everyone knows about. And you may be one of those who have stood in line for hours to buy from the Salty Donut. We'll get ready to test your diet as we talk about the sweet, sweet delight. All of that on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, it's the last day of hurricane season 2017, and not a minute too soon. After Hurricane Irma in September, it became tragically obvious that we're not doing enough to protect our senior population. 12 people died at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills after the storm, and those are ruled homicides. The center lost power because of the storm, and a couple of days later, people started dying. Governor Rick Scott shortly after ordered an investigation and tighter rules for nursing home facilities. There are roughly a dozen bills already filed for the upcoming legislative session focused on making sure that what happened in Hollywood Hills never happens again. We're joined now by the Sun Sentinel's Dan Sweeney, who's joining us via Skype to help us understand what some of those bills are and how the industry might change after this. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. So numerous bills have been filed, again, dealing with nursing homes. A lot of them deal with generators, or that it would require nursing home facilities to have adequate power during and after the storm in case of a power outage. And it seems that some of these bills really could be combined. But give us a basic idea of what's been filed so far.
Yeah, well, like you said, there's been at least a dozen bills filed dealing with nursing homes and assisted living facilities. It seems like there's another one added every day. Most of them simply require nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have generators that can power air conditioning units. There's already a law that they have to have generators, but these laws would make it so that they have to have generators that can power air conditioning. And the variance there is usually on how many days of fuel they need to have and other, you know, kind of details like that. But there's a lot of other bills out there, too, like a loan program so that smaller assisted living facilities can afford generators, for example.
And are we expecting more bills? Do you think there'll be more?
Well, you know, there are already so many out there. It's hard to say how much more ground can be covered. But in the House, they've got to have a special committee that they formed on hurricane response. And I would assume that committee, which will be looking through some proposals Monday, could have something on nursing homes.
All right. So what do you envision that the House and Senate are going to do pushing forward in final form? I mean, would they combine some of these bills? Do you think they have a chance? It would just seem obvious, considering what happened, that there isn't support on both sides for this.
Yeah. And you know, that generator requirement is the one thing that keeps coming up again and again. So I think some combination of a generator requirement along with some of the reforms that have already gained support in the nursing home industry is pretty likely. For example, nursing homes are in favor of a requirement that the facilities be listed as high priority for regaining power after a hurricane, which would put them kind of in a similar area as hospitals and first responders as far as how utilities prioritize where power is restored. So the nursing homes are pushing for that change. That's already in a couple versions of these nursing home bills, and that could be something that you see in the final form.
All right. So there's also a push to give the ombudsman a little more power. There's already an ombudsman program, right?
The elder care ombudsman, it's a state program, but it's in place because of federal law that requires it. Basically, it's a large group of volunteers that take complaints from nursing home residents and their families. And if they decide there's abuse or neglect, they can refer homes to law enforcement or to the Agency for Healthcare Administration.
So the bills, then, what are they going to do in helping the ombudsman? Are they giving the ombudsman more power, or is it just simply about getting more money to be able to, enforce the rules that already exist?
Well, there's just two versions of the bill, one in the Senate, one in the House, to deal with the ombudsman program. But it's extensive what those two bills would do. They're matching bills filed by Broward County Democrats, Katie Edwards in the House, Gary Farmer in the Senate. Farmer's district includes the rehabilitation center where those dozen people died. The bills would allow the ombudsman program to conduct undercover investigations of facilities, and it would hit facilities with really big fines if they're found to not be abiding by state regulations, up to $25,000 per instance.
All right. Right now, who runs the ombudsman program?
Well, the ombudsman is Mike Milliken, but the program is under the Department of Elder Affairs. So it is a state-run agency, and that's been the cause of some criticism in that some people say it hasn't been as active as it should be. The nursing home industry is quite powerful in Florida, and the Edwards Farmer bills would take the program and put it in the hands of an outside nonprofit.
All right, sorry, you cut out a little bit there. So yeah, one of the bills is basically takes the ombudsman out of state hands. Is what you just said.
Yes, it would take the ombudsman program and put it in the hands of an outside nonprofit that would be contracted with the state.
One of the things, too, I noticed is looking at some of these proposed bills, too, is to add more inspections, and some of them would be undercover inspections or investigations. I mean, how many people do they need to do this?
Well, I mean, theoretically, it wouldn't take much. There's already the volunteer ombudsman in the program. The bills by Katie Edwards and Gary Farmer would allow them to work undercover as residents or employees. There's already, like I said, a lot of volunteers in place now, but of course, this would be a much different job than what they currently do.
Do you see an issue with cost on any of these that might cause hesitancy with any lawmakers?
Well, it depends on the bill. I've mentioned that bill that has a matching loan program for buying generators. That could cost the state millions. But the generator requirement itself, it may not cost the state much, but it'll probably cost nursing homes and assisted living facilities hundreds of millions of dollars.
You know, when we look back at what happened, the tragedy at Hollywood Hills, you know, a lot of people, obviously, afterwards, a lot of people were talking about, you know, how could this happen? You know, we're supposedly, as a state, so prepared for storms. We're so well prepared for these kind of things. Really, I know that you said we do have a commission that's going to be coming up, a group put together just to look at what happened after Irma. But, you know, what have you gathered as to why did this happen? I thought we were prepared. We were ready to handle storms.
Well, you know, the industry would point out that this happened once in one nursing home, and that there are more than 600 nursing homes in the state, thousands of assisted living facilities, and that this tragedy took place in one, and that they call it that a tragedy, but an isolated one.
The other thing too noticed is that in the bills, there is a push to make sure that utility companies make nursing homes a higher priority.
Like I said, that's something that the nursing home industry is really pushing for as well. So because it's something that is a reform, and it's one that the nursing home industry actually agrees with, it's pretty likely that something like that would get into a final version of the bill.
Was the tragedy at Hollywood Hills enough to make changes in Tallahassee? Do you think, this kind of goes back to what I said earlier, I mean, it seems that there would be support on both sides for this.
Yeah, and there should be, but there's also a lot of other things hanging over the legislature right now. You know, the House and Senate leadership have their own priorities. And as with more or less every other nexus of power in the country, sexual harassment allegations have put a dark cloud over the process. There's an ongoing investigation into a state senator. So the question, though there is agreement in both chambers and in both parties for this, is whether a lot of that can be either put aside or quickly dealt with so the legislature can move on to issues like this.
Dan Sweeney again with the Sun Sentinel. We're looking at the issues of bills being filed in the Florida legislature for the upcoming session, which begins in January, looking at nursing homes. This again after the tragedy where 12 people died at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills after Irma knocked out the power. A few days later, people started dying. 12 people listed as homicides. So we're going to follow up on that story as well. Dan Sweeney joining us via Skype. A pleasure, Dan. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, coming up next, Miami Art Week, just around the corner. An interesting look at the art world in Miami. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. How many museums does a city need? Miami just got a new one. It's also home to a number of museum-quality so-called public art collections that you can visit as well, just like, well, a museum. Our journalist, Brett Sokol, is going to explain all of this to us as we get ready for Miami Art Week. Brett, a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
All right. The Institute of Contemporary Art just opened in the Design District. Tell us about this one.
The Institute of Contemporary Art Miami. We just got to give them their full props.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
They are the latest addition to Miami's contemporary art scene. They're opening up tomorrow in the Design District. Brand new three-story building, accompanying sculpture garden, the works. There's obviously a lot of excitement about them. They've purposely timed their opening for Art Basel, which unfolds next week when all cultural eyes, both local and international, focus on Miami. So they're hoping to grab a lot of that attention, make a big splash by, again, focusing on the kind of art that you see throughout Art Basel, contemporary art. Period.
And describe this, the building and the location, and how much space that they have to utilize.
Well, it's I guess you could call them an urban museum in a sense, in that there isn't a grand lawn in front of them. They are on 41st Street in the Design District. It's a 37,500 square foot building with a 15,000 square foot sculpture garden in the back, three floors. And I think, you know, one of the, you know, as you said in the introduction, there's an awful lot of museums popping here. There's another museum which is reinventing itself. You know, if the ICA Miami is the newest contemporary art museum to join Miami, one of the oldest, the Bass Museum in Miami Beach, founded in 1964, they have reinvented themselves. They reopened this past October after substantial renovations. They are no longer the Bass Museum of Art. They are just the Bass. Period. And that, again, speaks to their new mission. They are focusing on, you guessed it, contemporary art. And I think at a certain point, you start adding in the other museums in town. The Perez Art Museum of Miami also focused primarily on contemporary art. The Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami, from which the ICA Miami split off from, there, as their name implies, contemporary only. We've also got four other private museums in town, all owned by very well-known art collectors who have their own buildings with collections which are open to the public, many of them for free, collections that rival anything that you will see in the city's public contemporary art museum. So we've got eight so far and counting. There are more on the way, believe it or not. And I think at a certain point, you know, there's two questions to ask. All of these museums, even a private one like the ICA Miami, they're still looking to wealthy private donors, philanthropists, to support their budgets. And that's in addition to the public ones that need tax dollars. So at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, how on earth is Miami going to pay for all of these museums? It's not cheap. And then there's a second question. Do we need eight contemporary art museums in Miami? And again, just make this clear. These are museums that are just focusing on the latest of the moment contemporary art.
Yeah, you're not going to see classic artwork at these places.
No.
And isn't that always the case, though, is that, you know, it's, you'll always have the very wealthy have extensive art collections. Who's buying the art anyway when you talk about these amazing pieces that are bought up, for example, you know, at auctions? So we've seen that for centuries. The wealthy tend to have these massive collections and, well, unless you want them to just collect dust.
But this is a newer phenomenon that we're seeing, especially here in Miami, where it's not just that wealthy art collectors are snapping up pricey pieces of artwork. It's that particularly here in Miami, they're focused on just the newer stuff, not the older pieces. So, for example, if you spend a lot of time in Miami's art museums, you would think that art history began with Andy Warhol. And everything that came before Warhol might as well have been a cave painting.
Right.
And I'm not even talking about, you know, the Renaissance. I mean, like the 50s. The 1950s don't exist in Miami. They might as well. And so, you know, there's a parallel here with Miami itself. I mean, this is, as any time anyone has a complaint about something in Miami, you'll be met with the same response. Well, we're a young city. And, you know, I think that's also true with our art scene. It seems very young, but you know, you have to ask at a certain point, you know, can we, if Miami is a city with no real history to it. Do we also have to be a city with no real art history to it?
So, you know what? All right, look, this is going to open up, I guess, a Pandora's box. We talk about the, you know, this idea of an art city. So we have Art Basel. We have all these museums popping up. And it is an international city. But we can't really call ourselves an art destination, can we? Do we have enough? First of all, do we have enough well-known artists that are coming up that live here? Do we have the right art programs at the universities? And do we have more than just contemporary work in our collection that we could call ourselves an art city?
Well, I would definitely call Miami an art destination with an asterisk.
Okay, fair enough.
Because if you've lived in Miami, you know, long enough, and when I mean long enough, I don't mean 50 years. I mean before Art Basel came to town in 2002, you know what a sea change has happened here in the art scene because of Art Basel. And the biggest change has simply been that there are a lot of artists who can now make a living by being artists in Miami. And that may seem like a simple thing, but it was not true to any large extent before really 2000, you know, around that period, 2001, 2002. Prior to that, if you wanted to be an artist, you had and make a living as an artist, you had two choices. You could either get a teaching job or you could get a U-Haul and move to New York. That was it. There was really no market here. There wasn't really a way for more than a very small handful of people to make a living as artists just from selling their artwork. That's changed.
These museums and Art Basel, does it put enough focus on local artists, or is it all about art we're bringing in from the outside?
You know, there's a mixed record there, and I think there's definitely room in all of the institutions in town for more of a spotlight on talented local artists, not just because they're local, but because they're amazing artists who can hold their own with artists from anywhere else in the United States or Latin America or the world. Here's a great example of that, and let's give them credit where credit is due. Right now, the Perez Art Museum Miami has a wonderful career retrospective of the Miami experimental filmmaker Dara Friedman. You will see a huge array of the best of her work dating back, again, to the early 90s. Not farther than that, but she's a younger artist. But it's a great moment where you see a Miami artist getting the spotlight and being treated the way a great artist should be treated. That could definitely happen a lot more everywhere at all the museums in town. I think that there is a little bit too much of an emphasis, I would call it the Basel effect, of museums spending too much time chasing buzz, going after trendy artists who might have a bigger name in the art world, but frankly don't necessarily resonate with visitors to that museum.
I don't know how you're making me feel right now that I'm a big Picasso fan, and that just feels like that's cave paintings, I guess, compared to what you're saying. Let's come back real quickly, Brett, to the ICA Miami, and I just wanted to get a feel for it. I'm going to talk about their history, but, you know, their collection. Mm-hmm. What's going to be, you know, what can people expect when they open up? What's special about this one?
Well, first of all, we talked about local artists. They also are putting the spotlight on a really wonderful Miami artist. His name is Tom Elsa. He does absolutely gorgeous abstract paintings that draw on both the Haitian folkloric traditions of his background as well as decades of expressionist traditions. And he really fuses it into something new and exciting. And to the ICA Miami's credit, they've given him a whole room with these are, when I say big, I mean big, like 6-7 foot tall paintings. They will really knock you out. Throughout the rest of the museum, it's a little bit more of a mixed bag. There's some great stuff there. There's also some more conceptual work that I think might leave some people scratching their heads a little bit. I think some of it was chosen not necessarily because it is work that can have a transcendent effect on a viewer, but I think it sort of makes a statement about the kind of museum that the ICA wants to be. But that said, there are some incredible works. They have a group show called the Everywhere Studio. And again, it runs the gamut, but within that are some gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous Yves Klein paintings that are not to be missed.
Again, I'm talking with art journalist Brett Sokol because we are talking about Miami Art Week. It's Art Basel is coming up. And what we're looking, though, right now, what we're talking about right now, though, are art collections and art museums. And we have a lot of them, and as he's been mentioning, we have a lot of contemporary art in this city and not a whole lot of old stuff. Old stuff even going back to the 50s, which, you know, and I you know, I'm more of a Renaissance guy anyway, but... you know what? Before we take a break, I did want to ask you real quickly. The ICA has got an interesting history, and really, it's almost soap opera-ish the way it started. But just real quickly, just give us, you know, for those who don't know that story, how really it was created. It was from a split.
In a nutshell, I mean, it was a very painful divorce that happened in 2014. The Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami is owned by the city of North Miami. And when their director left that museum for the NSU Museum of Art Fort Lauderdale, Bonnie Clearwater, there was a bit of a dispute. Is that the tactful word we can use? Especially since it started involving very pricey lawyers and lots of angry accusations between between the board of MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and the city of North Miami over who that director should be and what really what kind of museum it should become, whether it was one that should be focused more on, say, the Haitian American community in Miami, or one that really pursued the idea of showcasing international cutting-edge contemporary art. It got ugly. There were accusations of elitism and racism traded back and forth. Then, of course, the city of North Miami, if you pick up the Miami Herald any day, you know that there's one after another political scandal unfolding there. So I think there was more than enough blame to go around. The way that it essentially ended was that the entire board of MoCA left and formed what is now the ICA Miami. MoCA is still there with obviously a smaller budget, new board. They're still doing some shows. They've got some stuff planned for Basel, but you now have two museums. If you want to say, you know, what happened to the children in any divorce settlement, the permanent collection, it was split up between the two of them. That's a joint custody, if you want to call it.
All right. That's a good way to put it. All of a sudden, we went from talking art to, you know, talking divorce.
Well,
all
it's
right.
Miami.
That's true. I'm talking with our journalist, Brett Sokol. Again, Miami Art Week coming up and just discussing really the art scene here in Miami. I wonder if you could say Miami. He says it's an art destination, but are we an art city? Can you compare us to New York or, well, Paris? Come on. But we'll continue this conversation coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined by art journalist Brett Sokol. And, you know, talking about museums, and Miami's got plenty of them, and more seem to be popping up. And another one's going to be opening up soon, the Institute of Contemporary Art Miami, in the Design District. We've been talking about that one. But, you know, just curious about if Miami is an art city. Let's come back, Brett, to the ICA Miami. It's free. Some of these museums are free. These are private collections. One of the other things, too, about the ICA, I'm glad you brought this up, we're talking about money, is the fact that, you know, the folks who founded it were angry at the fact that there was public money going into museums, and they don't want that.
Yes.
But does that model work?
Well, we're going to find out, how this all plays out. But that was one of the some of the main supporters and backers of the ICA Miami are Norman and Irma Brayman, who are very well-known civic figures in town. I sat and spoke with Mr. Brayman actually for a story that will probably be up on the website of the New York Times later this afternoon. It'll be in tomorrow's print edition. But Mr. Brayman was very, very clear, as he's been in many political struggles in the city, that tax dollars should not be spent on these museums. That Miami is, I mean, the census tells us, this is a fact, Metropolitan Miami-Dade is the second poorest major metropolitan area in the entire United States. And he's very aware of this, and he was very adamant in saying, we cannot spend tax dollars on a new museum. It's responsible for private philanthropists like himself to step up and fund these things. We need these museums, but taxpayers shouldn't be paying for them. And true to his word, he put his money where his mouth is. He and his wife footed the entire construction bill for this new museum, and admission is absolutely free all the time to everybody.
And the idea is to really to make art available to accessible to everybody, not just the elite part
exactly.
of the community. But really, when you think about, okay, so you like in any city, you have art artists coming into communities, and then the word gentrification comes up. And then, of course, who are the patrons and who are the people who are going? Is this really going to reach the average person and some of the people in communities that don't have access to art all the time?
You know, it's a very thorny question. I don't have a set answer for you. They're certainly aware of this because I posed this question to them. I said, you know, on the one hand, look, obviously you have free admission, but there are an awful lot of people in this area who look at the design district with its, Prada stores and Hermes and these high-end boutiques and restaurants, and they don't necessarily feel comfortable. And I think, you know, it's implicit on everybody in this community to take advantage of these things. Say, look, if it's free, we're going. This museum belongs to us as much as to anybody. And that's really true for any museum in town. I think it's up to this community to try to shape these institutions, especially the ones that are taking tax dollars.
Do we have too many museums? Especially if they're just going to focus on contemporary art.
I don't think you can ever have too many museums. I think we have, it's worth asking if we have too many contemporary art museums. And here's, you mentioned, okay, Picasso. There are some late era Picassos in the ICA Miami. It's almost like, if I can be cynical here, a sop to say, you want Picasso? We got your Picasso, okay?
That would make me happy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's worth asking, where are the earlier Picassos? Where are these earlier masterworks that again, people in Miami, if you want to see some of this older art, you pretty much either have to look in a book, you know, online or book a ticket to New York. Why can't we see some of these things in Miami?
Well, the closest I can come to is the Norton up in West Palm Beach.
Yes.
Where they do have old classics, I guess you could say, pre-Renaissance, Renaissance, and other centuries.
They do have some amazing older works in their permanent collection. You do have to drive an hour and a half on I-95, which is some people see as a death sentence.
Fly to New York instead. Okay. You know what? Is this, how much of this is really kind of a competition?
Oh, you it's know, an incredible. Are you kidding me?
All right, no. Well.
This is like Art World Game of Thrones.
Okay, now I'm intrigued. Let's go.
I mean, this is the very funny thing. If you talk to all of these museums and you say, you know, look, You now have four private museums with each of these collectors, each sort of flexing their aesthetic muscles, saying, look what I got, baby. And you've got four other contemporary art museums, you know, some that are public, or if you want to call them a hybrid, a public-private partnership, and the ICA Miami is private. And they'll all say to you, we're all colleagues. We're all the best of friends. We cooperate. Don't buy that for a second.
It's okay? Upsmanship.
It is complete one-upsmanship. And there are real stakes here, more than just bragging rights, because again, these museums, even the ones that are private, like the ICA Miami, they still have to rely on private donors to keep their budgets going. And they're all going to the same people for money. And you have to ask yourself, do we really have enough deep-pocketed billionaires to go around? I don't know. I mean, here's one thing. I looked at the Perez Art Museum Miami's tax returns, and they ended the year 2015 nearly $5 million in the red. I didn't see that reported anywhere else. It's in my article, but it does make you ask, well, obviously, there isn't, you know, enough money to go around for everybody if that's what's happening here. So there's going to be some kind of shakeout. Who loses? Who wins? You know, tune in next week.
What do you think Miami needs to, I guess, get to that next level of, you know, notoriety as an arts city? What are we missing?
Well, there's two ways of looking at that. There's what does it need in the eyes of some of these, you know, museum directors and the bold-faced named art collectors, and what does it need in terms of the artists or just the people who are going to see these shows at the galleries around town and in the museums? And those are two different questions. I know what the one crowd says. They want more blockbuster shows. They want things that grab them more media attention. But I think what Miami really needs is, first of all, more people to get involved in the art scene, going out to see these shows, even more people becoming collectors on a smaller scale, so artists, you know, can eat and pay their bills as artists. And, you know, if we come back to museums, I'd really like to see the museums in town make a little more space for older work. And again, I'm not saying, you know, drag out Renaissance era paintings. When I say older, I mean like anything from before the 80s. You know, I mean, politics didn't begin with the Reagan administration. Art shouldn't begin with the Reagan administration. And yet when we see these older works, it's like, well, one piece here and one piece there and a couple. I'd like to see more shows that really draw on the full history of art going back decade after decade. I think it would inform the way we look at newer contemporary work. I think it would create a more informed audience. I think people would get more excited and they'd be able to separate out more, you know, the dross. It's like that you know, that scene from the Blues Brothers film where the band goes into the bar and they ask the owner of the bar, what kind of music do you play here? And he goes, we got both kinds, country and Western. That's sort of where the Miami art scene is at now.
Before we finish up, how about this one, too? Is what do we have to do to attract more artists to want to make South Florida, Miami, but South Florida their home?
Oh, well, that's the easy question. You know, two things. They need, you know, affordable rent to live for their home and also for their studios. But they also need to have a homegrown art market of people buying the work. And this is, I have this conversation again and again when you say people, what is the, you know, what do artists need? And you'll hear everything from, oh, we need the museums to do X, Y, and Z, and we need the galleries to do this, and we need, oh, a graduate school program that does blah, blah, blah. All of that is nice, but it's extra. It's like gravy. What artists really need, okay, it's very simple. One, affordable place to live and to work, which is true for almost everybody in Miami. And number two, they need somebody to buy their work. So if you create a larger market for people buying their work, they can live. I know it's really that simple.
Brad Sokol, art journalist, you said your piece is coming out in the New York Times tomorrow.
It should be online later today and in tomorrow's print edition.
And we'll find a link as well so we can put it up on our website as well. And Miami Art Week just around the corner. So we're, you know what, that gives you a little taste, a little flavor to get you started. Brett, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, coming up next, we enter the world of gourmet donuts. Oh, we go from art to donuts. Perfect. That's on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so Monday morning when two different Washington officials showed up at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, each claiming to be the new acting director, almost every news story noted that one of them brought breakfast, boxes of donuts. The Bureau's general counsel ruled in that guy's favor, and later so did a federal judge. Now, I'm not saying donuts had anything to do with that. It was basically a power struggle between the CFPB and the White House, but there's no question that people love donuts. And here in South Florida, one of the founders of a very popular donut shop was just named to Forbes magazine's 30 under 30 list of entrepreneurs. They're right here in studio with me. Amanda Pizarro, along with her co-founder and husband, Andy Rodriguez of The Salty Donut. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, congratulations. I mean, first of all, this is, you know, Forbes 30 under 30. That's 30 across the nation. When did you guys find out about this?
I found out about, you know, two weeks ago. I was just normal day, minding my own business. And then I get an email, you know, congratulations, welcome. And then only within another week, I get, okay, now we're going to have a list launch party. And everything's just been going so fast.
And you guys were working when this was happening. I mean, it was just like, you know, you find out, but you're too busy.
Yeah, it happens to us kind of all the time. You know, we're very put your head down and work kind of people. So it's sometimes hard to take a step back and realize like, oh my God, this is happening right now because we're so caught up in just the day-to-day stuff, you know. But it's amazing and we're so excited.
What does it mean for you when you think about it? I mean, all the accomplishments you guys have had in the time that you've been doing this, but to reach this level, you know, now you're getting national attention. You were a little bit before, but now it's the Forbes 30 under 30. What does that mean to you?
I'm really excited about it. I think that this is kind of step two for the Salty Donut. And it kind of has opened our eyes to, you know, I think that the country is wanting our donuts. I don't think now that it's just Florida. It's kind of opened my eyes that I think New York can accept this concept. I think LA can accept this concept. So I think it kind of is just launching us into that 2.0 salty donut. Just because even when people see our donuts, and then now that we're, you know, for the Forbes, it's just it legitimizes us, basically.
You had, and look, you guys made a big step recently, because I mean, for at the beginning it was out of a trailer.
Yeah.
And anybody who's done who's had your donuts, they remember getting in that line out in Wynwood,
the baking sun,
just waiting, you know, and just hours, and this line just stretched and stretched, and now you've got an actual brick and mortar shop.
Yeah.
What's that step been like?
I mean, it's been a lot of learning. You know, we went from being opened 3 days a week for limited hours and selling out, and it being, you know, we sold out, you know, whatever, to people taking it a lot more serious. When you've got a brick and mortar, they expect you to have the product for longer periods of time. And so now we have to deal with being open 6 days a week, being open at 7:30 in the morning. I mean, it was a lot of changes and a lot of things that happened basically overnight. So we understood that process. We've tried to make it as, you know, seamless as possible. And then now that we've got a really great grasp on that, it's time, like Amanda was saying, you know, to apply the same kind of idea we did here, to go to markets that have nothing like what we have, because there really isn't anything, and apply that to other markets as well.
All right. Where did this idea come from? Where did the inspiration come from?
It originated with our love of food. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but we really pride ourselves on being really big foodies, and being born and raised in Miami, both of us, Andy and myself, it's kind of sad to see your city not have all these kind of cool concepts that other cities have. I mean, I think Miami is a little bit slow in trends, like just things that are going on in the U.S. And so it just so happened that donuts was kind of the one thing that we noticed was in every city wherever we traveled, but not in Miami.
Amanda, tell me about one city that you've traveled to where there's just a food thing going on that was just your favorite.
Aside from the donuts.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's kind of, I guess, not a trend as much anymore, but definitely I was a really big fan of macaroon ice cream sandwiches. Yeah, it's funny. I say it's not a trend anymore, but in Miami still hasn't seen a place like that, but they do like these giant macaroons and then put ice cream in the middle of them. So it's like a cookie ice cream sandwich on steroids.
Where did you find this?
In Southern California.
Oh my goodness.
He needs to know right now.
Oh my goodness. I'm just saying I'm planning trips. Okay, good. Wow. Andy, what about for you? What was something that you found somewhere that you don't see here, or just, you know, one of your most enjoyed, you know, foods that you've consumed somewhere else?
Oh man, you know, I love a great omakase sushi spot, you know, that doesn't have to be stuffy. So I want to go sit at a sushi counter somewhere, and I want the sushi chef to just give me whatever he wants to give me that is fresh that day that they bought at the market or flew in, you know. And that, again, is something very, I mean, almost impossible to find here. And if you do find it, it's extremely expensive and very stuffy. Places like Southern California, I can probably think of 10 places that you can go in, sit at the sushi counter and just say, you know, I want to do omakase. And they say, sure, let's do it.
Look, you guys know this area well. Why are we slow to catch up on some trends? What's the deal?
I think there's a lot of different reasons. And I think one of them is people execute at a level here that I almost feel is subpar to other cities. And by that, I mean, we'll get a place that is something that's popular in another town, and we'll get it, but the execution's so poor because I feel like they think the Miami consumer is not educated enough to know. And that's not the case. I mean, Miami consumers travel. They know what's good, but it's sort of like...
Or international.
Or international, but they have the cards that are dealt to them here. And I feel like people feel like they can do a subpar job here. But when you go to New York, when you go to Chicago, when you go to LA, if your concept is not hyper polished and something really spectacular, you're going to fail, you know? And I think that's sort of the idea we brought behind it, was polish the concept to something that would be amazing in any city and could take down any donut shop's quality and experience and lifestyle and brand, and do it here, not do the bare minimum to get through Miami, you know?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Andy Rodriguez and Amanda Pizarro. They are the founders of the Salty Donut. And again, as I mentioned, Forbes 30 Under 30 just listed them. That's a very big honor. Coming back to when you guys came up with this idea, you know, when did you know? Was it an aha moment? Was it easy to come by when you said, yeah, gourmet donuts? Or did it take time?
I definitely think it took a little time as far as like when we were kind of soul searching of like, what are, you know, what is the thing that we're going to do with our lives now? You know, Andy just left his last business venture and then I was still in school. So it took a little while to figure out that it was donuts. But then when we found out like it's going to be donuts, from there, before we launched, it was 2 years that we were developing everything. I mean, Unfortunately, donuts are not easy at all. I kind of sometimes say, like, I love the business that I'm in, but if I could do it all over again and do, like, cookies or cupcakes or something that does not, is not, like,
temperamental. I had somebody reach out to me the other day, and they were asking for advice. They're like, we want to open up a little donut concept. It's me and my wife. We're from, I don't know where they were from. And I was like, I would love to give you advice. Don't do it. Unless you're willing to spend every single day of your life breathing, sleeping, eating donuts for 18 hours of the day. If you're prepared to do that, then it's so satisfying and so amazing. But if you're not prepared to do that, this isn't like a little side gig.
You have a business background. You have a marketing background.
Mm-hmm.
So who? How did at the very beginning? How were you making the donuts? Who was making them?
So really early on, Amanda and I both, aside from having a passion for food, we both execute food technically from a making it standpoint at a very high level. I mean, we didn't go to culinary school, but we both are very amateur chefs. Like, we really know how to make things, and we really know how to make flavor profiles taste great, and we know when things are lacking contrast, when things are lacking texture, when things are lacking this or that. So for us, we hired a pastry chef when we first were getting open, and we really kind of had somebody that could execute the vision that we had. But we were in the kitchen pretty much every single day back then, mm-hmm. Making sure that everything was on point, both the way it looked, the way it tasted, making sure that the flavor development and flavor profiles were what we wanted it to be. And it was exhausting because a lot of things didn't work, and we had to go through so many different flavors. I remember making a list of, like, remember it was like 100 flavors, yeah. And we ended up picking, you know, six to start or whatever, three.
Oh, I would have loved to be the taste tester for you guys.
My family was.
Yeah.
That would have been fantastic. But you know what? What are like some of those concepts at the beginning, the first ones
that you guys had? There was a couple. There was like, popcorn and porter. That was fun. It was a porter beer with caramelized mm-hmm. popcorn. Yeah. You know, guava and cheese was something that obviously was really important to us from the get-go, being from Miami.
Oh, we did a Malta one.
We did. Malta and mariquitas. That yeah. was one that never really...
it didn't make it to the list.
The cut.
Oh, okay. All right.
That one never launched, but yeah, that was good.
What are some other ones that didn't make it that you thought might?
We did a matcha. That one was so funny. We did a baked, gluten-free, vegan matcha green tea donut, and we thought it'd be a great idea. I mean, matcha's great. It's earthy. It's beautiful. You can pair it with something like lemon, which gives it acidity and kind of helps cut. But when you actually put it together, it was just weird.
It was weird.
Earth, you know, toned from the matcha and the acidity of the lemon, but it was kind of brown, and it just wasn't very pleasant.
It
so we sold
cute.
It for about a day and said, yeah, let's not do that ever again. Didn't work for us.
So you brought in the chef to help you.
Yes.
And how long were you guys together? Because he's not with you anymore.
He's not. No, he was with us for about a year?
Maybe
About a year.
Who was it?
It was Max. Chef Max was our opening pastry chef. We parted ways early this year. And then our executive, Sue, who's been with us from day one, really, she stepped up, and she's got an amazing attitude. She's young. She's hungry, and she just fits our personality so well because Amanda and I are both really young. You know, we're both really young. We like to operate. We're not a restaurant. You know, I like to call ourselves like a tech startup that just happens to make donuts. You know, we've got that Google, Facebook atmosphere within the company. We have a lot of fun. We have young people working for us. We believe in young people. And so for us, it was a really refreshing, really amazing thing to kind of mold together a team of people that aren't trying to open a restaurant. We're trying to make donuts a lifestyle and a brand behind it, and really be able to expand in a way that's not your typical food group style. We are a brand, we are a lifestyle, and we make the best donuts in the country, but that just kind of comes almost like in tandem with the brand, you know, and being able to build a team of young people to do that has been really fun.
Yeah.
And I just to mention too, by the way, is Max Santiago, I didn't get his last name in there. You know what? When did you guys know that you clicked with your customers? Because the lines, again, when you were in the trailer, especially, those lines went for hours and you sold out really fast.
Yeah.
But when did you know, like, we did it?
I think it was January. So we opened December 2015, and then January 2016, it was kind of when the line started. And I think I noticed that, oh my gosh, like people actually really care about us. They really appreciate what we're doing with the, you know, our brand, our Instagram, our food. Because the line was actually, I heard it got to like an hour and 45 minutes. And, you know, and it's not, you know, even in January, Miami's hot. And these people are waiting there. And literally they comment, like, I'm baking in the sun, but I'm still getting donuts. And it's really flattering to see that. Because honestly, I don't know if I would wait in a line for food.
Even for your own donuts?
Come Maybe. On. No, for my own donuts, yeah. But for anything else, probably not.
I can't say I've been twice. And when you guys were in the trailer, and I thought I'd beat the line. I thought I was early. And no, I still had a long wait. That was quite amazing. What else is it, though? Because it's not like, you know, it's the modern age of marketing. You would know this better than any of us, Amanda, but what do you think it is? What is it, just word of mouth, or was it something I know Instagram's been big for you guys.
Yeah, Instagram has definitely been a really large market for us. I think, you know, it's been kind of easy for us because, yes, the product speaks for itself. It's beautiful. It tastes amazing. But it's kind of something that someone feels when they come to our shop. It's like we like to say, like, our shop has a heartbeat. Like a lot of places, it's a place to just eat and, you know, then you get full and you're temporarily satisfied. But for us, it's literally just it's a place for everybody to gather and have fun. And we're very about, like, family oriented, and especially the fact that Andy and I, you know, started this when we're both, I'm 25 and he's 30. And I think it's like we know what people want, and we're still a family owned business, actually. So I really try to push that, and very handmade and artisanal, because I think people really connect with that.
Yeah. And I think it's fun to see the reaction to the brand. Like, people come to the store to get the donuts, but they're also coming to the store to take a selfie on the brick wall that's got
Salty
logo. Yeah, the other day we were at Whole Foods and I was like, oh my God, that lady's wearing a Maple Bacon Change My Life shirt from the Salty, you know, and it's really fun. We get orders from people in Nebraska who are ordering coffee mugs from us. You know, it's so much fun to see people associating with the brand. And I think for us, it was from day one about, you know, 50% was about the product, 50% was about the customer experience. We want to make people feel a certain way when they go to the shop.
Now, again, you just moved into your brick and mortar place, but what's the next step? Where do you see the Salty Donut going now?
You know, I think it's been very delicate. We've been approached with every opportunity under the sun, and we're so grateful for that. But we don't want to take any steps that dilute the brand or hurt the product. And for us, it's been making sure we grow organically, making sure we have a grasp on the processes so that the customer experience and the product never change. And we've been figuring all of that out. I think, you know, Miami needs another store somewhere to be more accessible so people don't have to go all the way to Wynwood. But I think after that, you know, it's time to go to a different market. And I think we had an incredible amount of feedback when we were in New York for a pop-up a couple of weeks ago. I mean, thousands of people showed up and they were all asking us, when's the store coming? When's the store coming? So I think New York's a logical market for us. I think Los Angeles is a logical market for us. And I think sooner rather than later, you'll be able to see company-owned, non-franchised Amanda and I showing up there, stores in some other markets as well.
I'm not going to let you go without asking you. I'm wondering if maybe this is a future donut down the road, but what is the ultimate donut item you want to put on a donut or in a donut? I want to know right now. Amanda.
Me, black truffles.
Black?
She stole it from me.
Where is that in the line? When can we see this?
I don't know. I mean, I think very soon. We know even a local truffle hunter in Italy that we met on our honeymoon. So I really want to tie in that story and have him ship me some truffles.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm waiting for this one. Okay.
I'm Cuban. Amanda's Cuban too, but, you know, we both are from Spanish descent. We love Spanish food. We love Spain. I want to do like Cinco Jota Jamón Serrano. Serrano ham from Spain.
He's
on a donut.
Savory.
I'm going savory. Not full savory, but I think our donut's brioche. It's beautiful. It's bready. I think it works.
Yeah. Before we close out here, though, how long does it take for you guys to have, you know, conceive of a donut idea and then make it happen?
About 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah. It's a lot of testing. We come up with the flavors, even draw images of it, what it would look like, the layers. Test it out twice, yeah.
2 weeks, I'm saying. I'm waiting for the truffles. Don't make me wait. Don't make me wait.
2 weeks.
Amanda Pizarro, Andy Rodriguez, they are the founders of the Salty Donut. And again, as I mentioned, listed Forbes 30 Under 30 for people and foodies to watch. Congratulations again, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.